Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Hello and welcome to Pole Position, the motorsport show here on Rock Sport Radio. Andy Alston with you alongside Adam Todd, broadcasting on DAB Digital Radio across Central Scotland, online and on TuneIn. So on the show this week, you must be joking as McLaren turn to smoking. Who looks the best after the MotoGP tests? Bern can't be slow in Mexico. And who will steal the show as Rally heads for the snow? All this and more on Pole Position. Now, it's an exciting time in Formula One, with lots of teams revealing their cars for the new season. But one of the big stories comes from McLaren, as they've struck a new sponsorship deal with British American Tobacco. Now, tobacco advertising has been banned in Formula One since the start of the 2007 season or so. So, Adam, how is this possible?
Yeah, that's right. Bat's last involvement in Formula One, if you like, was at the end of 2006. And when they introduced those rules in 2007, it became very difficult for these tobacco companies to advertise their products and ultimately left the sport together. However, nowadays, with the different products that are now available, you know, in the move to kind of vaping and e-cigarettes, Ferrari have already renewed a partnership with Philip Morris with Mission Winnow, and McLaren's deal with BAT is now aimed to be kind of centred around this idea of BAT's transforming agenda, and their aim to deliver the world's tobacco and nicotine consumers a better tomorrow. So it's an interesting one, it certainly is. I was shocked when I got the press release through. It's interesting to see, but yeah, these companies are obviously coming back into the sport, and it's strange as well, because once that ban was implemented at the start of the 2007 season, you know, what odds would you have got that they would have came back in? Because you would have thought it would have got harder for them. But obviously with these new products that have come out in recent years, it's making them not easier, that's the wrong word to use, but easier to perhaps exploit loopholes or potentially areas and regulations that where these e-cigarettes and these products haven't been looked into as much.
So they're a tobacco company paying a lot of money for sponsorship, but they're not promoting tobacco? Something's not quite right here, Adam.
I mean, the question is, where do you start, really, isn't it? You know, you could spend a long, long time discussing this. People have their own opinions, certainly nowadays. You know, a lot of people aren't smoking as much as they used to. People aren't even starting to smoke as well. So it's a different era from when a lot of these companies were last involved in the sport. And it'll be interesting to see the reception that these companies get now they are back in Formula One.
So is it time for the FIA to step in now, before it's too late? Well, joining us on Pole Position to talk more about this is Stephen Camp from Motorsport Week. And Stephen, what was your reaction to this announcement?
I was slightly shocked, if I'll be quite honest with you. We last saw British American Tobacco with BAR Honda at the end of 2005, and it's not normally something that we see these days due to tobacco sponsorship being outlawed. Excuse me. We know Philip Morris have a long-standing association with Ferrari, but they don't have any blatant advertising on the car. But you know, another tobacco company making a step into Formula One, although it won't necessarily have a much of a major presence on the car, it's a little bit of a confusing moment, shall we say, in sports sponsorship.
Now, we understand that this is a multi-year agreement. McLaren say that it's focused on technology and innovation around what's so-called potentially reduced-risk products, but come on, I mean, you know, when people ask what's this all about, they're going to say it's British American Tobacco. Oh, British American Tobacco, well, here's their brands and so on. It's a little bit smoke and mirrors here, Stephen.
Yeah, good pun. It's a bit of a strange one. You know, the tobacco sponsorship has been sort of questioned in Europe sort of since the early 2000s, if not late 1990s, when, you know, we saw it on the Jordan with, you know, Beyond Edge and Buzz and Hornets, and, you know, Mild 7 having to black out their branding on the Renault. We even saw it with the Rothmans livery on the Williams, even in the mid-90s, where they sort of had to take it all out in when they did the French Grand Prix and the British Grand Prix. So it can be a bit of a strange one. It's weird why technology, perhaps maybe from the tobacco industry, feeds into the motorsport industry. I'm not sure where the two parallels come in there. It's a bit of a strange one. And obviously, we know Philip Morris uses Ferrari and also has branding on the Ducati MotoGP team as well. But they've got this new Mission Winnow thing that we first saw unveiled at the Japanese Grand Prix last year. But yeah, if they're sharing technology, it's a bit of a strange one as to what they could share.
Yeah, definitely. And Stephen, the telling part for me from this McLaren statement, though, is where British American Tobacco are saying that the sponsorship gives us a global platform with which to drive greater resonance for our potentially reduced risk products, including our Vype, Vuse and Glow brands. Now, Stephen, I think I'm right in saying that two of those brands are vaping products and the third is a tobacco kind of heating product that heats the tobacco to generate a kind of aerosol with a tobacco taste in it, which the user inhales. Now, I mean, to me, this is just replacing one form of nicotine addiction with other, and I appreciate we can go into a separate argument about, you know, the pros and cons of vaping, but I kind of think that British American Tobacco have showed their hand here because, you know, Philip Morris International with Mission Winnow that you mentioned, it's all a little bit vague and you can understand why, but here they're explicitly saying, here's three brands that we hope this sponsorship agreement will help generate interest around.
Yeah, it definitely does seem very blatant from their end. You know, here's what we're going to be advertising through McLaren, so it does seem a bit of a grey area. I'm not entirely sure on the legal standpoint where the EU backs may be coming on this as to how vaping products are allowed to be advertised. As far as I'm aware, they are. They sort of come under the same umbrella as, you know, branding for tobacco products. But it's certainly one to be looked at because obviously we've seen Philip Morris come under investigation from Australian authorities ahead of the Australian Grand Prix, which, you know, comes up in a few weeks' time. So it's a very much a grey area, which I think the FIA and the EU but maybe have to have a look at.
And British American Tobacco, they do have a long history in the sport, but part of me says that both AIM and Philip Morris, they wouldn't throw money at this in this manner if they didn't think they should get around it with a loophole.
No, you wouldn't have thought so. If a lot of money's being traded hands, it does seem to be some confidence between the two brands that they believe that there is, you know, a area where they do have a legitimate way to advertise their products through the two teams. You know, if another company comes in, perhaps maybe to, you know, sponsor another team, you know, for example, if Mild 7 decide to come back and try something through Renault again and renew ties there, then, you know, it could be something that, you know, there is that grey area that the EU and the FIA have to look at, or it might be something that they think, well, it does come under a grey area and there is scope that that can be allowed.
Hi Stephen, Adam here. Following on from what you're saying there, you mentioned tobacco sponsorship. It's been a big part now just to Formula One, but motorsport in general over the years. And the FIA, they first announced an intention to ban tobacco sponsorship back in 2001, well before it was eventually outlawed. So what can they do about this with the new season soon upon us?
It doesn't take long for paint shops within teams to remove stickers or repaint over something. So if there was a ruling to come in, I don't think it would affect the teams too much because there isn't, you know, an entire livery to perhaps take over the cars from. For example, like we had with Marlboro on the Ferraris or the Mile 7 on the previous run, all the Rothmans on the Williams in years gone by. So I'm not sure if it's something that's going to affect the teams too much if it does come under, you know, a ruling from some legal authorities that they have to remove those sponsorships. It could be something that, you know, that the teams may have to be prepared for if a legal standing does come in.
And McLaren, of course, are an independent entry. They're not a manufacturer in the same way as Ferrari, Mercedes or Renault. Do you think that's played a part in the deal? Because they have been struggling for sponsors of late.
Possibly. I think it is something that they have looked at, but they did get a large sum of money from the Latifi family last year. So, you know, money is not necessarily an area where McLaren overly struggle, but they do lack the levels of budget against the top three teams.
and Stephen's social attitudes are changing. There's been quite a mixed reaction to this announcement among F1 fans.
Yeah, it does seem to be that way. You know, a lot of people favour having the tobacco sponsorships back on the Formula One cars because we've had so many iconic liveries through the years. You know, back to the JPS Lotus, the Marlboro McLarens and Ferrarans, the Mile 7 Renault, the Rockmans Williams, you know, the Camel Lotus, the Camel, and even on the Williams in the early 90s as well. So there are plenty of, you know, iconic looks at Formula One cars that people recognise over the years. But it's also, like, as you say, it comes down to an ethical side of things. You know, should we promote, you know, vaping chemicals instead of smoking tobacco? It's a very difficult argument to get around.
Hmm. Stephen, there's been a kind of train of thought in the motorsport community that I want to see what your take is on it, because there's some people saying that this sort of arrangement wouldn't have happened under Bernie Eccleston's helm of the sport. Would you agree with that?
That's a tough one. You know, Bernie was in favour of doing anything that helped bring money into the sport, so I'm not sure if he would have, you know, turned his nose up and said, well, I'm not sure if that's a good idea to, you know, say no to a team bringing in perhaps maybe a tobacco sponsorship that's, you know, promoting vaping, for example. But, you know, if there was a legal standing, then, you know, if Bernie had to abide by it, then it would be one of those things you'd have to abide by. But I'm not sure if he would ever turn his nose up, you know, saying, oh, I'm not sure if you should do that.
Yeah, and just finally, Stephen, what's your gut on this? Do you think there's a risk that other teams are going to follow suit, or do the FIA have to respond to this quickly? Because if they don't, there could be a perception that they're allowing this sort of arrangement to continue, and there could indeed be a risk that it might start to feed its way through other tiers within the motorsport world.
I would certainly say that the FIA do need to, you know, clarify, do sort of open discussions with the EU on what is and what isn't allowed, and perhaps maybe even in their own community around the other worlds of motorsport to sort of come together and say, you know, do we need to put a stamp on it, or do we allow it in certain regions of the world, you know, and open discussions like that, because if other teams do start sniffing the opportunities and thinking, well, if they're doing it, then maybe we should look at it, and then, you know, soon you could have 6 to 8 teams, even the whole grid, you know, having some form of tobacco sponsorship coming back onto the grid. So it's definitely something that, you know, that grey area does need to be quashed.
Great stuff, Stephen. Thank you very much for your time here on the show.
No worries. Thank you for having me.
Stephen Camp from Motorsport Week there. And stay with us as we talk all things MotoGP up next on Rock Sport Radio.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.
Now, moving on to MotoGP, and it was Ducati's Danilo Petrucci who finished top of the timesheets at the first pre-season test of 2019. So joining us to talk more about the test in Sepang is Lewis Duncan from Motorsport Week. And Lewis, how impressed were you with Ducati's performance?
It was a fairly interesting performance, I would say, from Ducati. It's kind of hard to read into anything when it comes to testing, of course. You know, everyone's doing their own lots of, you know, different parts to test. Track conditions are always not quite representative to what you see sort of generally throughout the season. But Ducati hit the ground running in Valencia and at Jerez last November, and they've carried that forward. They didn't really bring too much different to the GP19 to Sepang. It was generally just refined bits. There was there was a new chassis to test and a new aero fairing as well. But generally, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, revolutionary brought. And it's clear they've got a good base set up on the bike. Petrucci, if you say, quickest at the end of that test, a 158.239, which is an unofficial lap record and absolutely smashes the lap that Jorge Lorenzo did on the GP18 to this test last year. That was a 158.8. So Ducati looking good form, both Petrucci and Dovizioso quite confident. Petrucci did admit after his race run on Thursday that he wasn't wholly convinced that they would be able to win the Sepang Grand Prix if it was to be held, you know, just a few days after that test. Of course, Sepang last year was where they struggled, you know, and at a circuit that they did well at in the test. So both were kind of wary of that, that the conditions that were met at the Sepang test weren't representative to what they'll experience when they get to the Sepang Grand Prix later this year. But yeah, Ducati definitely does seem to have the edge at the minute.
Hi Lewis, Adam here. Just on the subject of Ducati, a few of the riders from other teams, they seem to suggest that Ducati's one-lap pace looked very impressive, whereas on race pace, you know, it looked a lot closer. But of course, as you mentioned straight away, it is only testing. But is that what you took from it, that Ducati on the one-lap pace do look a lot faster than the rest, and on race pace when they're doing long runs, it's a lot closer?
Yeah, definitely, I would agree with that. I mean, if you look at the timesheets, the overall timesheets, I mean, you've got four Ducati there in the top six. I mean, it was a 1-2-3-4 Ducati, Petrucci, Bagnaia, Miller and Dovizioso. So certainly, over one lap, Ducati do seem to have that edge, which is, you know, we did see quite a few occasions last year that one lap pace was brilliant from Ducati. Race pace, yeah, is indeed a lot closer. You know, Ducati were up there, but, you know, Maverick Vinales and the Yamaha did a fairly encouraging race run that was quite comparable to the Ducatis. There's a couple of other sort of standout race runs as well. So definitely one lap pace does look like the Ducatis have, you know, got that edge. But it is worth noting that, of course, we didn't see Honda at its full potential. Marc Marquez is first time back on the MotoGP bike since having surgery on the recurring dislocation of his shoulder that he was plagued with last year. Cal Crutchlow, this is his first time since on the MotoGP bike since that horrific accident at Phillip Island where he shattered his ankle. And, of course, Jorge Lorenzo wasn't there. So the after the test, there was Ducati riders and management as well were quite quick to go, look, you know, we haven't quite seen what Honda have done yet. So, you know, we're not going to get too far ahead of ourselves.
And you mentioned Marc Marquez then. Can we expect him to be fully fit for the opening race of the season in Qatar?
Well, I think he was hoping to be initially, but, you know, after the first day on the bike, you know, he'd only just had his first ride out on a small 100cc sports bike just a few days before heading to Sepang, such has been sort of his winter of recovery after that operation, as I mentioned. And I think he did at that point sort of realise that, you know, being fully fit for Qatar will be a stretch. Does hope that he will be fully fit for the Argentine Grand Prix 2 weeks later. So he's going to go into Qatar on the back foot, sort of like he did a couple of years ago. You know, in 2014, he came into that sort of this pre-season phase having broken his leg in the off-season. Of course, he went to Qatar and won that, but it is clear that this injury has taken a bit longer to heal than you would hope. And of course, because he's been in that recovery phase, he's not been able to do the kind of training and physical preparations that he would normally do. So he was having to limit his runs in, at Sepang, you know, only 30-odd laps each day. He only completed about 105 or something like that across the 3 days. Didn't do any long runs. I mean, he was struggling a lot to do any more than sort of, you know, 5 or 6 laps in a row at any one given time. So definitely a race against time for Marquez to be fully fit for the season opener. But, you know, you kind of know what Marquez is like. If he can get into the ballpark, then he'll certainly be a factor come the opening round.
Absolutely. And one man you mentioned was his teammate Jorge Lorenzo. The fact he wasn't at that test, of course, he's moved from Ducati to Repsol Honda. So how much do you think he will have missed? Because, of course, track time's got to be crucial at this stage with Lorenzo making the transition from the Ducati to the Honda.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, he'd had those two tests on the bike in Valencia and at Jerez last November, and he wasn't fully fit for those either. He'd broken his wrist in that big crash in Thailand during the Thailand Grand Prix. And so his first time out in the Honda, you know, he wasn't fully fit. And of course, he missed those 3 days at Sepang. So he does go to the Qatar test, still with a race against time to be fully fit after breaking that left scaphoid again during some training just before Honda launched its bike, actually, at the start of the end of January. So, yeah, Lorenzo, not exactly the best preparation, but I think the thing that will be encouraging to him is first contact with the bike last November was encouraging. He was fourth fastest at the end of that Jerez test, and that was despite not being
fully fit. Now, if you look at Marquez's pace, he was 11th overall, but you know he topped the first day of testing at Sepang. Crutchlow was Cal Crutchlow in the factory-backed LCR Honda was 6th fastest overall. In fact, he reckons he could have gone maybe 6 or 7 tenths faster had he not crashed on the final day during his time attack. That would have put him, you know, very close to Petrucci's time. And you know, bearing in mind that Marquez and Crutchlow, first time back on the bike, they're still injured. The fact that the Honda's got that pace already underneath them, it shows that this 2019 bike has a very good base, and I think that there's quite a few of, you know, their rivals realise that. You know, Crutchlow himself wasn't happy on the bike, yet he would still be able to put in a very, very competitive lap time. So I think that'll be of big encouragement to Lorenzo. He'll see that, and you know, when he gets back on the bike, they should be able, you know, to gel into it better. He likes this bike more than the Ducati. It's a bit smaller, a bit more agile for him. And the fact that Honda have done such a good job of this bike, it seems already. You know, he's going to go to Qatar, yep, on the back foot, not with as many test miles under his belt, but he's not going to be massively cast adrift, I don't think.
And you mentioned Cal Crutchlow there. He was 6th quickest on the time sheets, and you know, you mentioned that he crashed out, but there's got to be encouraging signs for him. I mean, his first time back in the LCR Honda since that horrific crash in Phillip Island. So what can he achieve? Because, of course, last season it was the start that was a big thing for Crutchlow, because he led the championship, won the second race of the season, and things were going well. So do you think we could perhaps see a repeat of a strong start for Crutchlow this season?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, he put himself that he couldn't have hoped for a better comeback at the Sepang test. I mean, he was putting in a lot of laps. I mean, on the final day he did 61 laps. He was sort of hitting 50 plus 60, you know, laps each day, which is not bad considering, you know, of course, he's physical condition. Okay, fair enough, he's bad. He's had a lot more opportunity to build himself back up physically, get into the training, more so than Marquez has. But, you know, as I say, it goes back to sort of looking at the Honda as a package. You know, it has a really good base set up by the looks of it, you know, with Crutchlow being able to put in those decent laps. He knows as well that, you know, he's got machine parity with Marquez and Lorenzo. He knows his talent. It'll be interesting to see how Crutchlow compares himself to the factory riders this time, because he was always adamant beforehand that he was the second best Honda rider behind Marquez. Back in his Tech 3 days, he was always, you know, kind of quite adamant that he was sort of second best Yamaha rider behind Jorge Lorenzo. So it'll be interesting to see where he sort of slots himself into that kind of factory trio, how he sees himself against them. But Crutchlow is definitely aiming for, you know, a similar charge this year. He knows the bike's capable. He knows he's capable. Obviously, with a satellite team, yes, he's factory backed, but you know, he's not going to get quite the same upgrades as the factory teams will across the season, and especially in the second half of the season. That's when the gap tends to open up between the factories and the satellites. But you know, if you can get just off the line well in those first few races, just get back into it, ease himself back into it, then you know, you can have build up a really good campaign. And we are expecting to be incredibly tight this season, so you really don't know, you know, what's going to happen. You know, I wouldn't be out with the realms of possibility to see someone like Crutchlow challenging for that championship.
Oh, that would certainly be great to see. And finally, Lewis, Yamaha had a woeful season by their standards, I think it's fair to say, last year. This season, you know, Rossi, Vinales, from what they've said, they seem to be a bit more optimistic going into this season. So what can we expect from them? I mean, they can't be any further off than what they were last season, can they?
Well, that's the hope. I mean, last season, of course, they went between us in 2017 and Phillip Island last year. They went 25 races without a win, which is the longest barren spell Yamaha has endured in its entire Premier Class history, which dates back to 1974. You know, as you say, it really can't get any worse. And they have had a big shake-up over the winter. And, you know, in terms of personnel, we've had changes, you know, within Yamaha management. Kuji Tsuya, who was the former project leader, who was the man who made that rather, you know, embarrassing public apology to both riders during the nadir of that woeful campaign in Austria, when both were outside the top 10 in qualifying. He's been replaced within, you know, the team itself. Vinales has got a new crew chief in Esteban Garcia. Garcia worked with Vinales during his Moto3 days, and Vinales is convinced that Garcia is key to sort of his revival and confidence within the team. You know, he knows Garcia is going to keep him calm, which at times the fiery Vinales and his former crew chief, Ramon Forcada, he himself was quite fiery. They had, you know, clashes more often than not. So behind the scenes there's been changes. Of course, Yamaha operationally now have done changes. They've got a test team, a European-based test team for the first time, with Jonas Folger at the helm of that. So beforehand, the development of the bike was generally carried out in Japan and it was tested in Japan. They are splitting that now more so. You know, Japan's still got its role to play. There's more being done in Europe now, which, you know, kind of ties into what, you know, all the rivals are doing. You look at the likes of Honda and Ducati, for example. So they are learning, Yamaha. They're learning from the mistakes. The new bike itself, very positive signs. I mean, Vinales spent quite a lot of the 3 days working on the acceleration and the electronics with the new engine. And he said for the first time in his Yamaha career that, you know, as the 3 days went on, the progress made was constant. It was improving more so, and that was the first time he's ever experienced that. If you look to the test last year, you know, they struggled. They were quick one day, and then the pace just mystifyingly dropped off. So there's definitely signs there. Yamaha, as I mentioned earlier, Vinales put in a really impressive race run, comparable to that of the Ducatis. Rossi, a little bit, a few tenths shy of what his teammate's doing. He's not quite as convinced Yamaha in the ballpark yet, but what he does admit is that they are working better now, and he doesn't feel that they're lost anymore. So all the signs there are that Yamaha have made a big step forward. They're learning from the mistakes of last year. The bike's definitely a step forward. We're not going to know until we get, you know, into the season a few races, because they were quick in, at Sepang last year. They were quick in Qatar last year as well. And then, you know, things started to sort of fall away a bit. So, you know, we're not out of the woods yet with where Yamaha, but certainly compared to the last couple of seasons, they are in a much better place. And they do look like they are now back into that position where they can fight for the World Championship.
Lewis, great stuff. Always a pleasure to have you here on the show. Thanks very much for your time.
No problem, guys. Thanks for having me.
Lewis Duncan from Motorsport Week there, speaking to us on Rock Sport Radio. Now, Formula E returns this weekend with the Mexico City E-Prix, and Britain's Sam Bird goes into the fourth round of the season top of the championship. Now, joining us to look ahead to this weekend's action is Scott Douglas from our friends at the Checkered Flag. And Scott, do you think that Bird can pick up from where he left off in Santiago?
Oh, absolutely. The Virgin car, despite having a pretty shocking start in Saudi Arabia at the beginning of the season, has looked really strong from then on, and especially in the hands of Sam Bird. Got pole in Marrakesh and a podium, of course, and yeah, one last time out in Santiago, so he'll be expecting a win, if anything, if not a podium at least. So he's a form man coming into Mexico.
And what about his nearest championship rival, Hendra's Jerome D'Ambrosio? Didn't have the best of races in Santiago, so he'll be looking to bounce back.
Yeah, especially, it was an odd one for them. Mahindra looked so good in the first two races. Obviously, this Jerome D'Ambrosio's first season with the team. For them to get a podium first time out was a great result. The win, although unexpected, and obviously as a result of BMW self-destructing in Marrakesh, was a godsend. But, you know, they were in the right place to pick it up. And then, yeah, it kind of came to a shuddering halt in Santiago. Started at the back, made some progress through the field, but actually benefited more from drivers in front of him getting penalties. It was a worry for Mahindra, because they should have been more competitive there, and they'll need to be if they're going to stay in the championship hunt.
And reigning champion Jean-Éric Vergne, he's level on points with BMW Andretti's Antonio Felix da Costa. Scott, it looks to me that BMW and Techita kind of have the strongest packages on the grid so far, but they've just not seemed to have been able to take advantage of that.
Yeah, it's the bizarre world of Formula E this season, I must say. If you were ranking the two fastest cars, you would probably, it'd be a toss-up between the BMW and the Techita. How they are in the championship position that they are in, only they know. They, by far, the fastest car. The cost of start of the season, pole and the win in Saudi Arabia, looked like he could walk it. Then, of course, was the infamous crash in Marrakesh, which took him out. And then in the last race, you had the ludicrous position of Andre Lotterer running into the back of Da Costa, who then ran into the back of Vern. And in the end, it took all three of them out of the running, either in the race or to finish in the top 10. So it's been a disaster for them.
Hi Scott, Adam here. Vern and Andre Lotterer have both been critical of the qualifying format in Formula E. So what's the story there?
Yeah, it's an odd one. So in Formula E, with the four qualifying groups that you get, what it used to be done was that it was a lottery system. You would, each driver would draw a ball out of a hat, and that would dictate whether in the first, second, third, or fourth qualifying session. The traditional thinking being that the later the session you're in, the better chance you had. You got a cleaner track, and it was more rubbered in, so it should have been faster. It was a bit too random, though, and you'd often find championship rivals, say, fighting out for the championship, one getting drawn in Group 1 and one in Group 4, and they decided that was unfair. So they now join them together by their championship standing. But Tachita's problem last time was that meant both of their drivers were in early qualifying groups, and they did badly. The track was dusty, it wasn't rubbered in, they finished well down the order, despite clearly having a fast car, and it set them back in the race. And actually, when they did collide later on, you could say it was because they were having to fight their way through the field and unable to lead from the front like some of the others.
And Felipe Nasr, he's on the grid for this race. Tell us a bit more about that.
Yeah, it's an odd one. When Dragon announced that they were getting Maximilian Günther at the beginning of the season, it was a bit of an odd one. You were getting a lot of Formula One racing drivers, or a lot of drivers with, you know, a really high pedigree coming to the sport. And Günther, while a solid driver, maybe wasn't quite on the level of the others. So to see him replaced, it's a drastic decision. You know, he's not had a great start to the season. He's pointless. But he wasn't certainly driving badly enough to deserve to be replaced. Felipe Nasr, though, has a lot of backing, used to driving Formula One, and he's driven well in the series that he's been in since then. So he was linked to the sport earlier on in the year. It's not necessarily a surprise. I think he's going to find it tough, though. Formula E is a completely different kettle of fish from what he's raced in so far. For him to be thrown into Dragon after three races, it's going to take him a while to get up to speed. But interesting driver. A lot of people didn't think he got a fair crack of the whip in Formula One. So let's see what he can do in Formula E.
And Scott, what's your take on this HWA team? Because there seemed to be an expectation that they would hit the ground running, but that's not been the case.
No, not at all. At bottom of the standings, 0 points, 4 retirements out of six finishes. It could be much worse for them, I must say. They've got two very talented drivers. Gary Paffett's coming off the back of a very successful season in DTM, and Stoffel Vandoorne, although having had a bad couple of years in Formula One, has a stellar junior career behind him. So it's baffling. They've not got the reliability sorted yet. They've had a lot of technical issues. They seem to have the pace in qualifying, which is encouraging, but when it gets to the race, it just falls away. And a lot of that energy management, and a lot of it's software, actually, how they actually manage the energy as the race goes on, that's where they've really got a crack. But again, it's not a quick fix, and every time they do get it wrong, it's very public how badly they are getting it wrong. If they are the precursor to Mercedes coming in for next season, Mercedes have every right to be worried. And if it continues to be this bad, I'd imagine that they would get more and more support as the year goes in, because they're running out of time to get it right, in all fairness. They really need to start getting on top of these problems. So I'm not entirely sure things will be better in Mexico, but hopefully mid-season towards the end, you'll start seeing them turn it around.
Scott, it's a bit of a sense of deja vu here in some respects, because last season we had a very similar situation with Audi. They just couldn't seem to get things together early on. But what we've seen towards the end of the season is a much stronger outfit. Is there any chance that HWA could do the same? Because you could argue that they've got one of the strongest, if not the strongest, driver pairing on the grid. They've got everything in place, surely, for good things to happen at that team.
Oh, absolutely. They've got the drivers, they've got the personnel, they've got the infrastructure. They've got a fantastic racing pedigree. It shows you, though, how difficult Formula E is. It's so different from every other type of racing. You can't just arrive and drive. You really need to knuckle down and get used to it. The Audi situation last year was similar. However, I'd say that Audi beforehand had shown the raw pace their car needed, but they had an inherent reliability problem with the car that actually, after the problem in Mexico last season, they realized what that was. They were able to fix it, but it did take a couple of races to come in. With HWA, it looks more serious than that. It's not one thing that's going wrong every time. It's several things, and that does seem worrying. the fact they've got fast qualifying pace, though, does help. It shows there is inherent pace there. I don't think we're going to see a Phoenix from the Flames incident like we saw with Audi last year. I think it's going to be a lot tougher for them. But they, you're right, they have everything in place that they need in order to turn around. They just need to get it done.
And just finally, Scott, three different winners in the first three races of this new era of Formula E. Do you think that unpredictability will continue into this weekend?
I must say, with Tachita and BMW looking for, you know, wins, especially both Tachita drivers still not having won this season, there's every chance we could see another winner in the fourth race. It is fantastic. I must say, I've been speaking to lots of people who have been tuning into Formula E for the first time this season, finding out about the new cars, and now that they don't have to do the car swaps halfway, it's becoming more attractive. And actually, without the car swaps, you would have thought it would have been more predictable. And the opposite's been true. It's been chopping and changing every single race. You don't know who's going to win right up until the last corner. It's been absolutely superb. So, yeah, I must say, not only could there be a new winner this race, but I could see this continuing for several races. If it does, fantastic. But I think Sam Bird will probably be hoping to put an end to that.
Scott, great stuff. Thanks very much for your time, as always, here on the show. Now, moving on to the rally stage now, and we're all set for the second event in the World Rally Championship, with the action heading to Sweden. And joining us on Pole Position to talk more about this is rally expert David Halley. And David, there's a little bit of a sense of deja vu here in some respects, because here's Sebastian Ogier going to be clearing the road for everyone for the second year in a row.
Oh, he complains mightily about sweeping roads wherever they are. Different case up here in Sweden. As the weather changes over the weekend, this is the only true winter round of the championship. And earlier in the month, there was a lot of snow and a lot of ice about. But there's been some warm weather over the last few days. And there's a very strong potential that as the event goes on, the snow and ice will disappear and it'll turn into a bit of a gravel rally, which is interesting when you're on tyres with studs in them.
So, David, how did the manufacturers come to the right decision as to what tyres to use at certain stages or how the studs will perform in the gravel? How does that all shape up?
Generally, the stages will be snowy and icy, but as the cars pass, that ice gets dug up. Now, you're talking about hundreds of studs in a very narrow tyre. So the idea of these tyres is that the tyre itself goes down through any snow that's there, the studs grip the ice, and the speeds on this event are absolutely phenomenal. The cars are it's one of the fastest events in the championship, and it's on ice that neither you nor I could stand on. These cars are howling past it over 100 miles an hour. As the ice begins to disappear, the studs come out of the tyres because they get overheated. The studs get, they're like bullets, they get propelled into the inner part of the wings of the car like bullets. And if they then come across ice again later in the stage, the studs have gone. So it's a difficult one to balance. It's almost as difficult to balance as Monte Carlo and tyres.
So David, with that in mind, how do you think Thierry Neuville will approach this one? Because he won the event last year, narrowly missed out in victory last time out in Monte Carlo at the power stage. So what will his plan of attack be?
I think his tail will be up. Yes, he lost out to Sebastian Ogier at the very end of Monte Carlo, but he didn't disgrace himself, as Terry has a habit of doing every now and again. He knows how to win this event, but it is down to what the weather does. And when the ice and snow, and particularly the ice is very firm, there are ice snow banks along the side of the track, and the drivers will use these ice banks to guide the cars round corner and gain a bit of cornering speed. As they thaw, they become a bit soft, and there's a very great danger of the car, instead of just glancing off the bank, actually getting dragged into the bank, and then it's a 4 or 5 minute time out with the shovel getting the thing out of the bank. So a tiny mistake can have big repercussions on this event.
So David, with the weather conditions evolving, could that play into the hands of the likes of Andreas Mikkelsen, because it's a bit of a home rally for him in some respects, and Jari-Matti Latvala as well?
Well, again, Latvala's won the event many times. He knows how to do it. When you say almost a home rally for Mickelson, it does nip across the border into Norway.
Yeah.
So that there's bits of it that are a home rally for him. But yes, the Scandinavians are generally very good at this event. In all the years it ran up until 2004, it was only Scandinavians that won it. It took a young Frenchman, a guy called Sebastian Loeb. Don't know what became of him, but he won it to be the first non-Scandinavian. So it's got a bit of a history for the Scandinavians. Mm. We've got Pontus Tiedemann in the M Sport Fiesta, his second event in the World Car, and it's his home event, so he's hoping for big things too.
And with Pontus coming in there too, he's also alongside Elfyn Evans, Timo Sunnanen as well. How do you rate their chances? Because Sunnanen kind of, I rate him quite highly as a driver, but obviously Monte Carlo didn't get off to the best of starts, shall we say. But putting that to one side, he looked okay.
Absolutely. Temu has been very good with the occasional little laps, and if he could just iron those little lapses out. And the one on Monte Carlo, it was just arriving at a corner that was icier than he expected, and the car did not go round the left-hand bend. It went straight into the ditch, and it was bad enough that he was in the ditch trying to get it out when Callie turned up and punted into the back of him, and so it wasn't a great start, but once he'd got the car out the ditch and the rest of the event, he was there or thereabouts.
Mm. And David, just going back to Toyota for a moment, of course there's going to be a fourth Yaris taking part in this event with a certain two-time champion Marcus Grönholm behind the wheel. I mean, how much are you looking forward to seeing him in action at this event?
Absolutely. I'm really looking forward to seeing Marcus. Marcus has done a bit of testing for the team, so he's short of competitive seat time, but he's no slouch. He won't have forgotten how to wring the neck of a World Rally car, that's for sure.
Mm. David, to me this almost feels like a bit of a first rally of the season in some respects for Chris Meek, because again, another driver who ran into problems early on in Monte Carlo, but didn't he finish that event strong as well, taking the win in the power stage?
Absolutely, Chris, in the first, second, third or fourth Toyota. I don't know which way round they are at the moment, but he's certainly, we know he's got the speed. He just needs to get that little bit of luck that the likes of Sebastian Ogier seems to have when all others are falling off fairly innocuous corners or whatever. Sebastian just seems to be able to hang on to it. And if Sebastian goes off, he bounces straight back on again. Nothing seems to drag him into a ditch.
Hmm. Definitely. And what about just the last man in that Toyota that I'd want to get your thoughts on? Oit Tanak, ninth last year at this event, because he finished second in Monte Carlo on that occasion. What does he need to do? What has he got to be aware of at this event?
I think, again, it's down to seat time. If you remember, this time last year was only his second event in the car, and he's spent a lot of time getting that car to his liking. He's got the more powerful engine now. I think he will still feature. I think his ninth last year was okay, but not by his high standards. He got round. I think this year he'll be in the hunt.
Now, David, it's the time we've all been waiting for. It's the predictions time.
Oh, no.
I'm going to be keeping track of the scores throughout the season. I'm the self-appointed independent adjudicator for this, the Rocksport Rally Awards, I think, or we can call it that. Andy, I'll start off with you. Who do you think will win this one?
Honestly, and you could argue this might be a left field choice, but I honestly think Latvala could do it. I mean, yes, he struggled a bit in Monte Carlo, particularly towards the end, and I know Neuville was very strong at this event last year, winning it pretty comfortably, but I think if Yari Matti can start well, then he's got every chance. But do you know what? Either way, he's going to write his way into the record books this weekend as well, because he'll become the driver to have made the most starts in history of the World Rally Championship, and maybe a win on Sunday will just be the icing on the cake for him.
And David, what about yourself?
You think Latvala's left field. How about Loeb for the win? I think Sebastian, yes, he inverted the car in testing, but if you invert the car, you're going quickly, you're trying things out. I think he's going to be an interesting choice. I'd love to see, he won it in 2004, let's see if he can do it this year.
All right, and let's see how we go on as well. David, thank you very much for your time, as always, here on Pole Position. All right, let's get the Superfast Scots roundup now with Glenn Alcock. And Glenn, of course, you're competing in the Citroën C1 Cup this year. One driver who's now going to be alongside you on the grid is Emily Glanville.
Yeah, that's correct. So we just missed that, unfortunately, last week. I think she announced it the next day. So she's going to be doing her second full season of racing. She says she can't wait. A train of C1s dive bombing over Duffus in the rain, three wide on two wheels, she said, what's not to love? So it does sound good fun, and it'll be interesting racing alongside her.
And Glenn, what else has kind of been catching your eye in the Scottish scene this week?
Yeah, so just staying on the theme of women in motorsport, so Gillian Sefton, she's been appointed as SMS, so that's Scottish Motorsports National Development Manager, and she says she's delighted to be offered this exciting opportunity to help grow the sport we're all so passionate about. I'm sure you'll join me in wishing her all the best in her new role. If you don't know about SMS, so it's got representatives from clubs associated with two- and four-wheeled motorsport in Scotland. It was formed in 2011, and if you check out scottishmotorsports.co.uk for more info, and I'll stick a link up on Superfast Scots on Facebook as well.
And there's been a little 50 years celebration to look forward to as well.
Yes, that's correct. So Formula Ford, we are going to be having 50 years of Formula Ford, and that will be during the July 2021st. SMRC round at Knock Hill. So it's also a tribute to David Leslie, who was the 1978 Formula Ford Scottish champion, but he's famous for his successes in British Touring Car Championship with the Courier Cos, and then moving on to Nissan. He was a great mentor and inspiration to a lot of Scottish drivers, David Coulter, Dallin McNish and Dario Franchitti are, you know, ones who say that they couldn't have achieved what they did without the support of David Leslie. The first Formula Ford Championship in Scotland was in 1969, and it was won by Tom Walkinshaw. If you're a Formula One fan from back in the day, you'll remember Tom was involved with Benetton and Arrows in Formula One. And he's been, basically, he was the first champion of that series, which has been a great launch pad for careers of some of the drivers I've already mentioned. So, you know, Alan McNish, David Coulthard, Rory Butcher, Johnny Adam, they've participated in it, and it's still a very strong series and good to watch if you come along to Knock Hill. Talking about Formula Ford, a couple of other wee things just to mention. So Cameron Thompson, I've talked to you about him before, so he's a 16-year-old that signed for Graham Brunton Racing, and he'll be driving with them in Formula Ford this season. So he passed his ARDS test yesterday, so he's all good to go. Another bit that's links in with Graham Brunton Racing, so Jamie Chadwick, she's not Scottish, but she is another famous driver out there. She won the MRF Challenge single-seater championship in India, and she raced in the Walter Hayes Trophy for Graham Brunton Racing previously as well. So she'll be a good inspiration for Logan Hannah, who will be racing with Graham Brunton this year. Another couple of wee things just to mention. Mm-hmm. So Courier Cos, Colin Noble. So he's going to be competing in the European Le Mans Series this year alongside his teammate Tony Wells. The pair won the 2018 UK LMP3 Cup, and Colin took the title in 2017 alongside Alistair McCaig. So Colin said he hoped to pick up where he left off and challenge for wins immediately. So we wish him all the best in that as well. And a former young Courier Cos driver, Gordy Much, so he's entering his third year of car racing. He's only 16 years old, and he'll be racing a Ginetta GT5 with Fox Motorsport, who he was with last year in the GT5 Challenge Championship. He ended last year at Donington on the podium, so he'll be hoping to build on that this year. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's good news for Gordy.
And just staying with Gordy, Glenn, you know, I remember Adam and I up at Knock Hill last year to watch him taking part and watch the British Touring Car Championship in general, you know, and the conditions were very, very challenging, shall we say, and he coped with them admirably. Yeah. It was very, very impressive that day.
Yeah, that whole day was horrendous, if you remember how bad the weather was, and the onboard footage is, you know, you see it and you think, oh, how can they see, you know, where the track's going, and Gordy is very talented, and he's been a good mentor to some of the young go-karters as well. It's good if you go along to the likes of Lark Hall and stuff, you see him there, and he's trying to pass on already what he's learned to the younger drivers coming through, and that's really good to see. That's something you want to continue as his career progresses. Talking about, you know, drivers who have managed to inspire younger generations, Jim Clark, the Grand Tour, which is, you know, it used to be the Top Gear team, basically, of Richard Hammond and James May and Jeremy Clarkson. They've done a tribute to Jim Clark, and you can watch it on Amazon Prime. It's really been done very well. You know, they can be quite out there at times and can be quite cheesy and stuff, but this was done in the way that it should have been, and it's a great tribute to Jim. And Richard Hammond drove his iconic Lotus 25, and it's really something to see. And you can still donate to the Jim Clark Trust. Go to the Jim Clark Trust. If you just Google it, I'll put a link up on Superfast Scots as well. There's still time to help. You know, this museum's going to be something really, really special to celebrate Scottish motorsport and Jim. And I think, you know, it's something we all really want to be involved in.
Yeah, definitely. And Glenn, just kind of looking ahead to the next few weeks or so, anything else we should be keeping an eye on?
There's going to be the first test for the SMR season, which will be next month. So it's going to be March 17th, and I'll be involved in that and hopefully get out in my car. I'm hoping to be able to get a little bit more information on that out there shortly, so you can watch the space for that. That's going to be good for everybody to get on track, and it'll start to give us an idea of, you know, how people are looking competition-wise for this year. There is an event that I should be attending next couple of weeks as well, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that after it's happened, because it should be quite exciting, and a lot of people from Scottish motorsport will have there'll be a wee forum and a chance to talk to some people that have accomplished quite a lot. And that's pretty much it at the moment. I mean, it's relatively quiet, I suppose, as we get ready for starting racing. But there's a lot of excitement, I think, as we shape up for 2019.
Great stuff, Glenn. Thanks very much for your roundup, as always, here on Pole Position.
Thank you.
That's the Superfast Scots roundup with Glenn Alcock there. All right, now it's time for a little bit of this.
Final lap on Pole Position on Rock Sport Radio.
Now it's that time of the show, Adam, as you tell us six stories from the world of motorsport this week in just 60 seconds. Now, you got this month off to a great start last week, Adam, so let's see how you get on this time round, as your time starts now.
XF1 driver Mark Blundell will return to motorsport this year when he makes his debut in the BTCC at the age of 52. He's with Trade Price Cars Racing and will drive an Audi S3 alongside Jake Hill. Staying with the championship, and Lewis Hamilton's brother Nicholas is back in the series with a full 30-round entry with motor-based performance. The Carlin team will race in sports cars for the first time this year when they take part in the European Le Mans series. They're in the LMP2 category with a Dallara P217. There's talk that some F1 drivers could take part in pre-season testing without a helmet that has been homologated to the FIA's safety standards. That's because ARA is said to have only passed part of the FIA's test. Mads Osberg will make his WRC Pro debut in Sweden this weekend, driving a Citroën C3 R5 after missing out on a World Rally seat with the French firm for the season. And finally, Claire Williams has said that her team's new sponsor is all thanks to a signed bottle of HB Sauce. She brought the bottle to a meeting with their new title sponsors because she knew the chairman was a big fan of the sauce.
Ah, right, okay. Right, we'll give you that one. You're just in time, maybe a couple of tenths of a second.
Yeah, that's good. I thought I was heading up to the stewards there for an inquiry, but I'll take that.
Fortunately, that's all we've got time for on Pole Position this week. But we'll be back from 8 o'clock next Thursday night to do it all again. My thanks to Adam, to our guests, and to you for joining us as well.
Love music. Live sport. Pole Position with Andy Alston and Adam Todd on Rock Sport Radio.